These three vehicles will carry almost 2,000 people on a 100 million kilometer voyage to another planet, Mars. Most of our future Mars colonists will be transported in the second ship, the Nina, which will depart 3 weeks from today. Our ship, the Pinta, and the final spacecraft, the Santa Maria, will each carry about 300 passengers, as well as the supplies and equipment necessary to sustain the colony. This global subterfuge was the response of the Council of Governments, or COG, to Nicole's video, which had been received by a tracking satellite in the year 2241 and had been quickly classified as top secret. The easiest way to meet the intent of the Nicole Desjardins video and not alarm the populace, the COG concluded, would be to announce and fund a large colony on Mars. When the Pinta was 3 weeks away from Mars, the staff announced a coming two-day communications outage and urged everyone to call home before the radio systems were temporarily out of commission. On the first day of the planned communications blackout, an announcement was posted on every operations channel that an important program required viewing for everybody would be shown at 2 o'clock that afternoon. When the program at last came on, Dr. Werner Koch, the director of the ISA, could be seen sitting behind a large desk.
Passengers on the Pinta. 4 years ago, our satellite tracking systems decoded a coherent signal that had apparently originated in deep space. Nicole Desjardins, whom, as you all know, we have long believed dead, appears on the video, claiming that another Rama spacecraft of the kind that visited our solar system in 2130 and 2200 has now come to our neighborhood to acquire a representative sample of 2,000 human beings for observation. You and your associates aboard the Nina and the Santa Maria will become the contingent that the Roman intelligence will observe. From this moment forward, all communication between your vehicle and the Earth will be strictly controlled.
In the Watanabe apartment, where Judge Mishkin and Max Puckett sat watching the program with Kenji and Nye, a silence had fallen. Max was the first to speak.
Well, I'll be goddamn, he said.
You'll be in charge here while I'm inside Rama, Commander McMillan said to his deputy, a handsome young Russian engineer named Dmitry Yulinov. Your primary responsibility is the safety of the passengers. If you hear or see anything, even remotely suspicious, move the Pinta away from Rama.
It was the morning of the first reconnaissance mission from the Pinta into the interior of Rama. The 16-member scouting party, led by Commander McMillan, penetrated the external seal and proceeded down a broad corridor to a circular room from which a tunnel led still deeper into the alien spacecraft. Max Puckett, who had been selected as one of the four soldiers in the operation, grumbled that the military equipment he was carrying severely restricted his freedom of movement.
I'm a farmer, not a goddamn commando, he complained to Kenji,
who was also a member of the party.
This is ridiculous.
When they entered the tunnel, two figures suddenly appeared at the other end. As the figures grew near, a shiver went down Max Puckett's spine.
Well, I'll be damned, he said. There's Abraham Lincoln.
And Benita Garcia, the famous Mexican cosmonaut, said another soldier.
We come to welcome you, said Abraham Lincoln.
And to take you to New Eden, Benita Garcia added. The scouting party, alarmed and suspicious, stood speechless before the Bihots. Max Puckett finally broke the silence.
Are you a ghost? I mean, are you really Abraham Lincoln?
Both Benita Garcia and I are human Bihots, the Lincoln replied matter-of-factly. We are designed with specific capabilities to free human beings from repetitive tasks. My areas of specialty are clerical and legal work.
Max was dumbfounded. Ignoring McMillan's order to stand back, he walked up to the Lincoln and put his fingers on its face.
Incredible. Absolutely incredible, he said, diffusing the tension.
The Biots escorted the scouting party to a bullet-shaped vehicle that carried them through a transportation tube and deposited them in the enclosed annulus that completely circumscribed the Earth habitat module. Upon entering the annulus, the humans found themselves in an atmosphere the same as Earth's and discovered that they were no longer weightless. The annulus, though, was so dimly lit that the colonists were unprepared for the bright sunlight that greeted them when the Lincoln opened the huge door to the habitat itself. In truth, they were awestruck. It was all much too large, much more magnificent than they had pictured. The scouting party was led to a train that carried them to the center of New Eden and its central city with its large and impressive public buildings. What do you think? Kenji asked Max after an extensive briefing by the Biots in which the layout of New Eden was explained and the rest of the Biots introduced. They were standing at the entrance to the great hall where they were about to be served dinner. I cannot think, answered Max. I keep pinching myself just to make sure I'm not dreaming. Dreaming or not, the humans all agreed that the simulated roast duck was staggeringly authentic, and so were the wines. As the evening progressed, they grew more comfortable with their Biot companions and peppered them with questions. At first, nobody even noticed when a solitary female figure appeared in an open doorway. But the room quieted when Kenji Watanabe jumped up and approached the newcomer with an outstretched hand.
Dr. Desjardins, I presume, he said with a smile.
Shortly thereafter, the process of moving the travelers on the Penta into New Eden began. But where would everyone live? In a decision that would later have significant consequences for the colony, almost all of the 300 travelers on the Penta elected to live in Beauvoir, where the Wakefields had already settled. Only Max Puckett and a handful of farmers who moved directly into the farming region along the northern perimeter of New Eden decided to live elsewhere in the colony. The Watanabes moved into a small house just down the lane from Richard and Nicole. From the beginning, Kenji and Nicole had established a rapport and a friendship rapidly developed. On the first evening that Kenji and Nai spent in their new home, they were invited over by the Wakefields to share a family dinner.
The stories you have told us, Nai said, as the meal ended, are absolutely astonishing. Do you know who built the node?
That, Richard said with a smile, is definitely a level 3 question.
Can we move on to more trivial issues? Katie interjected. For example, where are all the people my age?
Most of the younger set are aboard the Nina, Kenji responded. It should arrive here in about 3 weeks with the bulk of the colony population.
I want to go out and see the lights, Benji said. Will you come with me, please, Ellie?
Ellie Wakefield stood up and took Benji by the hand. The two of them said goodnight politely and were followed out the door by Katie and Patrick.
We're going to see if we can find anything exciting to do, was Katie's parting shot.
I just realized we have spent the entire evening talking about your incredible odyssey, Kenji said, turning to Nicole. Certainly you must have questions for us. After all, 45 years have passed on Earth since the Newton was launched.
45 years, Nicole thought. Is that possible? Can Genevieve really be almost 60 years old?
Her daughter had been a young girl when she last had seen her.
We know absolutely nothing about our families, except what you told us briefly that first night.
As a matter of fact, Kenji said, I went back through my journals and read again the entries I made when I was doing the preliminary research for a book on the Newton. I saw Genevieve and her husband, and she was extremely courteous, which surprised me, considering how much she had suffered during all the meteor uproar in 2238. That's when it was announced by England's royal family that Genevieve is a king's daughter. I realized, after speaking with her, that the book would only open up old wounds, so I dropped the project.
Tears came to Nicole's eyes as she thought of Genevieve. She hoped that the revelation hadn't been too painful for her.
Thank you, she whispered to Kenji.
Richard caressed Nicole's shoulder. How many of the Newton cosmonauts are still alive? He asked, trying to keep the conversation going.
Only Sabatini, Tabori, and Yamanaka, Kenji replied. In 2208, David Brown had a massive stroke and died. Admiral Hyman died of cancer in 2214 or so.
Irina Turgenev suffered a complete mental breakdown, a victim of return to Earth syndrome, and eventually committed suicide in 2212.
And Francesca Savatini, Nicole asked, has she gotten what she wanted? Fame and riches beyond compare?
Pretty much, Kenji said. I wasn't alive during her heyday in the first decade of the century, but even now she is very famous.
Kenji was silent for several seconds. Back in 2208, just before Dr. Brown died, he had occasional lucid periods in his generally incoherent state. During one such period, he gave a fantastic interview to a magazine reporter. He confessed partial responsibility for Vorsov's death, and he implicated Francesca in your disappearance. Francesca said the story was poppycock. She sued the magazine for 100 million marks and then settled comfortably out of court. The magazine fired the reporter and formally apologized to her.
Francesca always wins in the end.
When the passengers from the Nina finally arrived, Nicole spent 13 hours helping to process them. It was an exhausting day. No matter how hard she and Kenji Watanabe and the others worked, none of the passengers ever seemed satisfied, and many of them were downright petulant when Nicole explained the allocation of food, living quarters, and working areas. The following evening, Patrick and Katie attended a dance at the school gymnasium. At 12:30, Patrick realized it was time to go home and went looking for his sister. He found her outside in the playground with several men he didn't know. They were all smoking and laughing and drinking from a bottle that was being passed around. One of the men placed his hand on Katie's breast. She pushed it away, still laughing. Then she grabbed the man and kissed him wildly on the lips, pressing her body against his. Patrick was embarrassed.
"Let's go now, Patrick," Katie said with a smile. "I think that's enough for one night."
The passengers from the convict ship, the Santa Maria, were assimilated into the colony with surprising ease. They were all assigned to various posts within the community. One convict, a French woman known simply as Eponine, was given a job teaching at the high school. Her professional credentials were impeccable, and her demeanor was so gentle that when she maintained that the murder for which she had been in prison had in fact been in self-defense, her interviewers were inclined to believe her. There were even two physicians among the convicts, and the colony hospital was willing to employ them. At first, the other seven doctors working there were leery of their new colleagues, especially Dr. Robert Turner, who, like Eponine, had also been convicted of murder, but he did not mention any of the extenuating circumstances which mitigated his crime. However, after a week or so, his extraordinary skill, knowledge, and professionalism became apparent to everyone, and the staff unanimously selected him to be the director of the hospital. Dr. Turner was quite moved and astonished by his selection and pledged in a brief acceptance speech to dedicate himself completely to the welfare of the colony. His first official act was to propose to the provisional government that a full physical examination be given to every citizen of New Eden. When his proposal was accepted, he deployed a Nawi Tiaso biops throughout the colony to perform the examinations and gather data for the doctors to analyze. The chart that most troubled him was Malcolm Peabody's. He was virtually certain that Peabody was suffering from the heart disease that had killed another convict en route to the colony on the Santa Maria. It was well known among the convicts that the deceased, a man named Walter Brackeen, had become Eponine's protector and lover on board the ship, but had been Malcolm Peabody's lover while they were in prison together. It seemed unlikely that Malcolm and Walter had contracted the same disease by coincidence. The fact that the pathogen was, in all probability, communicable, raised a terrifying specter. Turner was also completely mystified by a curious finding involving genetic classifications within the colony. Two of the people tested, Benji O'Toole and Ellie Wakefield, could not be grouped with the rest of the colonists. In Benji's case, Whittingham syndrome could be held accountable for the anomalous finding, but as far as Ellie was concerned, Turner did not know what to make of it. Since she was obviously in good health, the doctor dismissed the matter as of little consequence. The disease that had killed Brackeen was far more troubling.